Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. Iran calls for Yemen ceasefire. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani called Tuesday for an immediate ceasefire in Yemen, where Houthi rebels have seized territory and drawn in a Saudi-led campaign of airstrikes backing President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi. Mr. Rouhani says a proposal for a halt in fighting, talks among the Yemeni parties, and the formation of an inclusive government are the ways to solve the country's crisis. An airstrike on a missile depot near the city on Monday set off a massive explosion, killing at least 25 people and wounding hundreds more. The airstrikes continue as the United States is deploying an aircraft carrier to join other American warships in the waters near Yemen, and what the Pentagon said is a move to ensure vital Gulf shipping lanes remain open. Spokesman denied the ships would be used to intercept Iranian vessels suspected of smuggling weapons to the Houthis. Italian prosecutors said Tuesday that the Tunisian captain of the migrant boat that capsized in the Mediterranean mistakenly rammed his vessel into a merchant ship that was coming to its rescue. The prosecutors in the Sicilian city of Catania said the captain steered his dangerously overloaded boat into a Portuguese container ship just before it capsized off the coast of Libya last weekend, drowning as many as 900 migrants seeking to escape poverty and war in the Mideast and Africa. There were only 28 survivors rescued. Prosecutors said the 27-year-old migrant boat captain, Mohamed Ali Mahalik, was arrested under suspicion of multiple homicides, causing the shipwreck and aiding illegal immigration. You are listening to The Voice of America. At least 7 people are dead after a car bomb exploded Tuesday outside a busy restaurant in the Somali capital. Reuters news agency reports militant group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility. Abdulaziz Bilo has more for VOA from Mogadishu.
Somalia Security Ministry says it can confirm the deaths of 7 people in Tuesday's blast, which took place outside a popular Mogadishu restaurant. Another 8 were badly wounded, according to the ambulance service. The explosive-laden vehicle was parked right outside Banoda restaurant opposite the Hotel Central, where a double suicide explosion in February claimed 20 lives. The government now wants public support to counter possible attacks. The constitution minister says we want civilian support. Anyone in Mogadishu must assist the security forces with information. Abdulaziz Bilal for VOA News, Mogadishu.
An Egyptian court sentenced former President Mohamed Morsi to 20 years in prison Tuesday in connection with the killing of protesters in 2012. He escaped a possible death penalty, with the court ruling that he and 12 other Muslim Brotherhood leaders and supporters were guilty of intimidation and violence, but not murder. The charges are related to clashes outside the presidential palace that started with Mr. Morsi's Islamist supporters attacking protesters who were rallying against a decree declaring his decisions could not be challenged by the courts. Nearly 2 weeks after convicting Johar Tsarnaev for the deadly bombing of the 2013 Boston Marathon, a federal jury will return to work Tuesday to determine whether to sentence him to death or life in prison. Prosecutors are seeking the death penalty against the 21-year-old Chechen immigrant for the deaths of 3 people in the bombings. Chinese President Xi Jinping hailed the profound friendship between China and Pakistan on Tuesday during his first state visit to the Southeast Asian country. Addressing the Pakistani parliament, President Xi praised Islamabad's anti-terror efforts, saying Pakistan and China share a common stake in security. In his own address to lawmakers, Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif said Islamabad and Beijing, quote, will fight together to eliminate the menace of terrorism, end quote. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is hailing the change in U.S. policy toward Cuba and cooperation in education, energy, and trade with other Latin American countries. He's hailing this as a transformative moment for the Americas. Kerry said the Summit of the Americas in Panama earlier this month was a 7th such gathering, but in some ways the first, as it marked the first year Cuba was allowed to attend. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
International agencies report the latest boat tragedy in the Mediterranean, which may have killed up to 800 migrants and refugees since Saturday, is the deadliest on record. Only 28 people are known to have survived the shipwreck of a wooden fishing boat carrying 850 people from North Africa to Europe.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also, an Egyptian court sentences former President Mohamed Morsi to 20 years in prison today in connection with the killing of protesters in 2012. And at least seven people were killed today when a car bomb exploded outside a busy restaurant in the Somali capital, Mogadishu. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, an Egyptian court has sentenced ousted Islamist President Mohamed Morsi and a number of his former associates to 20 years in prison for the killings of protesters outside the presidential palace in 2012. The sentence is the first of several to be handed down in cases pending against Mr. Morsi. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
An Egyptian military helicopter took off carrying ousted President Mohamed Morsi Tuesday, shortly after he was convicted and sentenced in the first of a series of trials he and political associates are expected to face. At least three others are pending.
Mohamed Morsi Al-Ayat. Mohamed Ibrahim Al-Biltain.
The 20-year sentence the former president was given is lighter than many observers had been anticipating, yet overly harsh for most of his supporters. 12 of the former president's aides were also given 20-year sentences, and two others received 10 years. During the trial, the defendants, including top Muslim Brotherhood leaders Issam Al-Aryan, Mohamed Baltaghi, and the group's supreme guide Mohamed Badia, gave a symbolic four-fingered salute from behind the soundproof defendant's cage. Brotherhood supporters used the salute to protest the bloody military operation to disperse the group's protest camp outside the Rabah Adawiya Mosque in the north of Cairo in August 2013. At least 600 people were killed before the operation was over. Supporters of Mr. Morsi burned tires in at least several locations in the capital, Cairo, Tuesday to protest the verdict. Muslim Brotherhood leaders outside Egypt condemned the verdict and urged supporters to show their displeasure with it. Amr Darag, a former minister in the Morsi government and leader of his Freedom and Justice Party, insisted in a statement that the former president was a brave and honorable man and a committed Democrat who was chosen by the people. Darag also claimed that Tuesday's verdict was a travesty of justice and that it was scripted and controlled by the government. Veteran editor and publisher Hisham Qasim tells VOA that it is possible Egypt's judiciary had its own motives for wanting to punish Mr. Morsi and his associates.
The Brotherhood were going to make an early retirement for one-third of the judiciary in order to bring in their men and Islamize and Brotherhoodize the judiciary. And the judiciary have taken offense over this. So that is something I bear in mind.
Qasim went on to argue that Mr. Morsi and his Muslim Brotherhood associates, unlike former President Hosni Mubarak, who was tried on similar charges of brutality against protesters, may have done a bad job of covering their tracks.
The difference between Mubarak and Morsi is Mubarak, as he was going under, knew he was going under. And he is a rational man whose judgments are earthly. The Brotherhood did not believe they were going under. They believed divine intervention was going to take place. And so they weren't covering their steps properly, as opposed to Mubarak, who left very little evidence of misdoing.
The verdicts against former President Morsi and his associates can still be appealed. Several cases, including breaking out of prison in 2011, collaborating with external enemies of Egypt, and handing state documents to Qatar, are still pending. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Thank you, Edward. The rights group Amnesty International also calls the Morsi verdict a travesty of justice. It says Egypt's criminal justice systems appears incapable of delivering fair trials for members or supporters of the former president's administration and the Muslim Brotherhood. Amnesty says Mr. Morsi should be retried in a civilian court with international standards or be released. At least seven people are dead after a car bomb exploded today outside a busy restaurant in the Somali capital. Reuters news agency reports militant group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility. Abdelaziz Billow has more from Mogadishu.
At least seven people are dead after a car bomb exploded Tuesday outside a busy restaurant in the Somali capital. Reuters news agency reports militant group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility. Somalia Security Ministry says it can confirm the deaths of seven people in Tuesday's blast, which took place outside a popular Mogadishu restaurant. Another eight were badly wounded, according to the ambulance service. The explosive-laden vehicle was parked right outside Banoda restaurant opposite the Hotel Central, where a double suicide explosion in February claimed 20 lives. Somalia's Constitution Minister Hussein Mohamed visited the scene of the blast and condemned Al-Shabaab's disregard for civilian lives. He says the target today was a civilian restaurant. It's not a government institution. Those who lost their lives were women who made a living by selling fuel and food and young innocent children. Somali security forces, ambulance units and the fire department were on the scene to put out a post-explosion blaze and attend to the injured. Authorities in Mogadishu have beefed up security this week after the militant group increased its attacks on soft targets within the country and beyond. The government now wants public support to counter possible attacks. The Constitution Minister says we want civilian support. Anyone in Mogadishu must assist the security forces with information. Those injured will be treated here, and special cases will be flown to other countries for specialized treatment. Somali and African Union forces have driven Al-Shabaab from most of its strongholds, but the group remains a threat, as shown by its recent attacks. On Monday, at least seven people lost their lives, and seven others were injured in an attack claimed by Al-Shabaab in Gurowe, the main city in Somalia's Puntland region. Another attack on Sunday killed three AU soldiers from Burundi. Al-Shabaab also claimed responsibility for the attack at a Kenyan university that killed nearly 150 people. The Somali government recently placed bounties on the top 11 leaders of the group. Abdulaziz Bilal for VOA News, Mogadishu.
South Africa's defense minister says the government will deploy military personnel to prevent further violence and criminality after a wave of xenophobic attacks in two cities that have killed at least seven people. VOA's Anita Powell has more on the story from Johannesburg.
After weeks of violence in impoverished areas of Johannesburg and Durban, South Africa's defense minister announced Tuesday that soldiers will join with police to stop the xenophobic attacks. The attacks, which began earlier this month, have displaced hundreds of African immigrants and led to hundreds of arrests. Defense Minister Nosiviwe Mapisa-Nqakula described the situation as a crisis. Immigrants from African nations, including Congo, Ethiopia, Malawi, Nigeria, Somalia, and Zimbabwe, have been among the targets of the attacks. Many have sought temporary shelter at makeshift camps, while some African embassies say they are seeing a steady stream of citizens trying to return home. National Defense Force spokesman Brigadier General Tlalani Mabanga declined to give details of the military operation. He did not say how many personnel would be involved, what the operation would entail, or even where exactly they would go, though he said they would be sent into hot spots. Those are likely to include the Johannesburg township of Alexandra and the impoverished settlement of Isipingo near the coastal city of Durban.
The plan is to provide the necessary support as may be required or requested by the South African Police Service in areas where the South African Police Service thinks or deem it necessary that they need the assistance and support from the South African National Defence Force.
Mabanga stressed that the National Defence Forces were requested by police authorities and that they have previously responded to calls for backup, such as during the last round of national elections in 2014. He also offered a message of encouragement to everyone in South Africa, wherever they come from.
I'll tell them that their safety and security is of concern to the South African National Defence Force.
Since the end of apartheid in 1994, the nation has been a magnet for millions of immigrants from elsewhere in Africa. Some critics of the nation's immigration policy say there are not enough jobs to go around for South African citizens. About a quarter of the population is unemployed. And many South Africans who were disadvantaged under the unfair apartheid system say they have yet to see the economic equality they fought for, which has led some of them to blame immigrants for their woes. Even with these harsh conditions, South Africa has been shocked in recent days by images of the brutality shown towards foreign residents. On Saturday, a South African journalist captured shocking photographs of four men stabbing Mozambican national Emmanuel Sithole in Johannesburg. Sithole was attacked just stumbling distance from a clinic. But the clinic's doctor, a foreign national, did not report to work that day because he feared being attacked himself. The photographer helped Sithole to the nearest hospital, but he died of his wounds. The four men were arrested and appeared in court Tuesday. The presence of soldiers in poor, mostly black areas is likely to recall a very different era for many South Africans. During the apartheid years, soldiers from the South African Defence Force were heavily involved in policing what were then black-only areas. That fact may not bode well for the soldiers preparing to go into tense areas now. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. At 17 minutes past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. An Egyptian court sentences former President Mohamed Morsi to 20 years in prison today in connection with the killing of protesters in 2012. And at least seven people were killed today when a car bomb exploded outside a busy restaurant in the Somali capital, Mogadishu. And for all the latest news, please visit us at our website at www.voanews.com. Sporadic demonstrations have erupted in Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa. Protesters are reacting to the execution of about 30 Ethiopian Christians in Libya by a militant group affiliated with Islamic State. A video of the beheading of approximately 15 migrants and the shooting of an equal number has been attributed to the extremist group. The victims were apparently seeking passage to Europe. In a special session, Ethiopia's lawmakers have declared 3 days of national mourning starting tomorrow. Ethiopia's foreign minister says the government is ready to repatriate all willing nationals at its own cost for such perilous places like Libya. And international agencies report the latest boat tragedy in the Mediterranean, which may have killed up to 800 migrants and refugees since Saturday, is the deadliest on record. Only 28 people are known to have survived the shipwreck of a wooden fishing boat carrying 850 people from North Africa to Europe. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
All of the 28 survivors have now been taken to Catania, Sicily. Most of them are from sub-Saharan Africa, from Mali, Gambia, Ivory Coast, Eritrea, Senegal, and Sierra Leone, as well as from Bangladesh and Tunisia. 24 bodies recovered from the capsized boat accompanied the survivors on their grim journey to Catania. This latest tragedy caps a week of horrific and multiple deaths on the Mediterranean Sea. The International Organization for Migration reports 400 migrants drowned when their boat capsized south of Malta on April 14th. Another 50 were killed a few days later. IOM spokesman Joel Millman says the death toll for 2015 so far stands at 1,727 migrants, making this a particularly murderous year.
With this latest count, IOM calculates that the 2015 death toll now is more than 30 times last year's total at this date on April 21st, when just 56 deaths of migrants had been reported on the Mediterranean. Through the end of April last year, 96 migrants had perished, indicating that the last week of April had been the deadliest period of the year to date. IOM now fears that the 2014 total of 3,279 migrants on the Mediterranean may be surpassed this year in a matter of weeks and could well top 30,000 by the end of this year.
The UN Refugee Agency says the death of more than 800 migrants is clearly another wake-up call for Europe, which must find the ways it means to address the escalating tragedies unfolding in the Mediterranean. While UN officials welcome a 10-point action plan by European Union ministers, they say the devil is in the details. UNHCR's Director of International Protection, Volker Türk, says the plan must prioritize the protection of asylum seekers.
There is a lot of emphasis on law enforcement measures, on smuggling and trafficking, on various types of cooperation. We believe that given the fact that there is a whole region in crisis that is adjacent to Europe, that displacement is not going to go away. If you look at some of the displacement numbers, we are talking about a global displacement crisis that is playing out at the doorsteps of Europe. It's clear then that the European political leadership will need to provide the appropriate response, which is built on the fundamental European values and human rights and human dignity.
Volker says the UNHCR hopes the EU will incorporate into its plan a number of proposals it has made to ensure the protection of migrants. These include enhancing resettlement prospects for refugees, humanitarian admission, and alternative legal channels allowing migrants to enter Europe. He says search and rescue operations should be increased and people should be screened to see if they qualify for international protection. Currently, Greece, Italy, and Malta bear most of the burden of receiving and assisting the thousands of migrants crossing the Mediterranean. Volker says the European Union must agree upon a fair distribution of asylum seekers in need of international protection among its member countries. As of now, he notes, Germany and Sweden host most of the refugees coming from Syria. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A new study says the hippopotamus is very important to the health of Africa's rivers and lakes. That's because hippos produce a key ingredient for aquatic life and a lot of it. But researchers warn that hippo populations are on the decline and that could damage ecosystems. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The mighty hippopotamus is the third largest land mammal following the elephant and rhinoceros. Its name is derived from the ancient Greek for river horse. Hippos spend up to 16 hours a day in the water and venture onto land at night to feed. They eat tropical grasses, more than 200 kilograms per meal. And what goes in must come out. And there is the magic ingredient for Africa's aquatic ecosystems, dung. Douglas McCauley and his colleagues decided to study it.
Well, we started looking at hippopotamus and realized that a big part of the story was their poop, was this vast amount of nutrients and energy that are moved across systems via their eating and their defecation.
McCauley is an assistant professor of ecology, evolution, and marine biology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He says hippos cross the boundaries of ecosystems.
Transiting between two different domains, between land, the terrestrial world, and then the aquatic world, means that they're also these important nutrient vectors because they're eating lots and lots of stuff on land and then taking that all back to the place where they rest in the water and lakes and rivers and then basically dunging that all out. And it turns out, when you start crunching the numbers, to be a huge amount of material and energy and nutrients, of the sort of natural fertilizer that's moved across these boundaries.
So each hippo contributes, if you will, over 60,000 kilograms of dung to African lakes and rivers every year.
It's a big animal. We're talking about an animal that's about 4,000 to 8,000 pounds, so it's got a big appetite. When you look across the entire continent and our estimate of how many hippos we now have in sub-Saharan Africa, that comes out to millions of kilograms.
So by now you understand it's a tremendous amount of dung. But did you know that hippo dung looks like straw?
That's right. So they are mostly feeding on grass, sort of a straw-like grass. In fact, a lot of Acheron grasses are used as straw or forage for cattle in places like America. So they have these wonderfully well-developed lips that they use like a lawnmower to go across these short grass lawns that they actually manicure. And they keep them short because it seems to keep this resource accessible just to them.
McCauley says it's even used as a communication device.
They actually use dung as a kind of signal amongst themselves. So a male animal will dung at a subdominant male. They actually fling it back and forth with their paddle-like tail.
But the really important thing about hippo dung is its place in the food chain.
Well, there's a lot of good stuff in dung. There's a lot of nitrogen, carbon, even a bit of phosphorus. And some of these nutrients can be limiting in river systems. These are sort of the building blocks of life in some cases. So it really is injecting more of this food into these rivers. And a lot of the animals, it seems, in the rivers are quite happy to receive it. Some of them eat it up directly, and some consumers, like fish, will eat insects that started their lives feeding on dung.
McCauley actually describes it as a life force in Africa's rivers and lakes. But he says if the water flow is too low, the dung could overwhelm the ecosystem and be a pollutant. Too much water and its value is diluted. But as researchers learn more about the importance of hippos, there are fewer of them.
Hippos are declining across sub-Saharan Africa. In the past decade or so, we've seen about a 10 to 20% decline in their numbers. And beyond how many there are, they're in a lot fewer places. There are entire countries that have completely lost hippopotamus. Egypt, for example, hippos used to be a iconic god. It was the god of birth in Egypt. You know, you see these hippo gods, it's a female goddess turning up on amulets and wands and swords.
McCauley says humans are responsible for most of the decline in the hippo population through hunting and habitat loss as human populations spread.
They have to have water. Well, guess what? Everybody else wants water, and it's really unfortunate if you've tied your fate to water, because when you compete with humans for water, you often lose. So people want water from rivers and lakes for building out cities, for helping to cool turbines. We're damming rivers.
It's estimated hippos kill about 3,000 people a year. The animals may attack, for example, if people get too near a mother and calf. McCauley says careful thought must be given to the management of water, both for humans and wildlife. He says if managed intelligently, there should be plenty of water to go around, adding that the fates of humans, wildlife, and ecosystems are closely tied together. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
What's up, Africa? It's Jackson Vunganyi.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Cape Town.
Can I be upfront with you? That's exactly what Nadia and I plan to do every Wednesday at 1730 UTC. Upfront looks at issues that affect you.
Since the world is moving at a faster rate, they need to have a native computer.
Interesting news.
Canadian man was sentenced for drunk driving after being pulled over in his mother's motorized wheelchair. The 35-year-old man was fined and placed on probation.
And of course, music. No clouds in my stones. Entertainment, celebrities, you name it, we'll talk about it.
And of course, we love to hear from you. Send us your thoughts and comments. Our email address is upfront@voanews.com.
So don't forget to check us out every Wednesday at 1730 UTC on The Voice of America. Yeah.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. An Egyptian court sentences former President Mohamed Morsi to 20 years in prison today in connection with the killing of protesters in 2012. And at least seven people were killed today when a car bomb exploded outside a busy restaurant in the Somali capital, Mogadishu. Coming up, we'll have a little music and our feature reports. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Tuesday, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are kicking off today with African club football.
Kim, joining us once again on the Sunny Side of Sports is David Legg, our African football guru. Sporty greetings, David.
Thank you, Sunny.
Let's kick off with African club football, David. First leg, last 16 action in both the CAF Champions League and CAF Confederation Cup tournaments. Let's begin with the Champions League, David. And first, how about the results?
Right, Sonny. It was USM Algier of Algeria 2, Kaloum of Guinea 1, Sanga Belende of DR Congo 0, Al Hilal of Sudan 1, El Marak of Sudan 1, Esperance of Tunisia 0, Ulma of Algeria 1, Faxian of Tunisia 0, Leopards of Congo Brazzaville 1, Smouha of Egypt 0, Maghreb Tetouan of Morocco 1, Al Ahly of Egypt 0, Raja Casablanca of Morocco 2, Entente Sétif of Algeria, the defending champions 2, and finally Stade Malien of Mali 2, TB Mazembe of DR Congo 2.
Taking a look at those results, David, did any of them really surprise you?
Interesting question, Sonny, because we had five home wins, two draws, and just one away victory. And that really was the shock of the first legs. And that was Al Hilal winning in Kinshasa. Now, I say shock because Sanga Belende, not an experienced side in the Champions League, where it tends to be Vita and Mazembe who represent DR Congo, but Belende had won their two home games comfortably. On the other hand, Hilal came to Kinshasa with a poor away record this season. They'd drawn one and lost one, and those opponents came from Malawi and Zanzibar, who are pretty modest by African standards. But nevertheless, a goal from Massawi with 4 minutes left, and he's an interesting character because he's 35 years old, and that's for a midfielder. You're getting on a bit, Sonny, because that's an area of the field where you've got to do an awful lot of running. But good for Hilal, because that one-goal victory away means that a draw at home in Omdurman will see them through. But the really high-profile games, they produced their fair share of drama. You had Tetouan against Al Ahly, Al Ahly record 8 times African champions, and this was decided by a goal in stoppage time by Ayajur. Now, Ayajur has scored 6 goals now in the competition, and he is what I would call the arch-predator of the CAF Champions League of 2015. On the other hand, Raja Casablanca, who in the previous round had eliminated Kaiser Chiefs of South Africa, they had to come from behind not once but twice against Sétif, the defending champions, to force a 2-2 draw in a thriller in Casablanca. It wasn't a great weekend for the Egyptians because Smouha suffered a similar fate to Ahly. They went to Congo Brazzaville, and they also lost by 1-0, with AC Leopards now having the only 100% record in the Champions League this season. They've played 3, they've won 3, and every victory has been by 1-0. It was certainly a good weekend for Algerian clubs, and 3 of them are competing. And the reason, Sonny, you've got 3 instead of the normal maximum of 2 is that the defending champion, Sétif, are also coming from Algeria. USM Algier, they led, were brought back to level, and then took the lead again to get a 2-1 home victory over Kaloum. Now, the disappointing part of that from an Algerian perspective is conceding that goal at home, and that could prove very costly after the return match. On the other hand, Ulma, they upset Faxian of Tunisia 1-0. If you're going to win at home by 1 goal, that is the result to achieve, 1-0. It means that if Ulma could score once in Tunisia, then Sfaxien have to score three times. Another really exciting draw was that between Stade Malien of Mali and TP Mazembe of DR Congo, who have won the African Champions League four times. Mazembe coasted to a 2-0 lead, and they were still two in front with 15 minutes left and probably thought it was game, set and match. But Ismaël Koné, the Stade Malien striker, had other ideas, and he struck twice in just 60 seconds to bring Stade Malien level. But nevertheless, with home advantage to come in the second leg, you would certainly fancy Mazembe to qualify.
David, let's turn to the CAF Confederation Cup tournament now. And how about the results?
Ons Couturiers of Mali 0, ASEC Mimosas of Ivory Coast 1, Djeliba of Mali 1, Hearts of Oak of Ghana 2, Clef of Algeria 1, Club Africaine of Tunisia 1, Wari Wolves of Nigeria 2, Etan Chieti of DR Congo 1, Zamalek of Egypt 0, Fuz Rabat of Morocco 0, Munana of Gabon 2, Orlando Pirates of South Africa 2, Young Africans of Tanzania 1, Etoile Sahel of Tunisia 1, and Royal Leopard of Swaziland 1, V Club of DR Congo 0.
And which of those results, David, caught your eye?
Well, the first one that caught my eye, Sonny, was that the Giant Killers, Royal Leopard of Swaziland, have done it again. They've beaten V Club of DR Congo 1-0 at home in the first leg of their last 16 tie. And it was Makonto, after 43 minutes, who scored the winner. Now, he's also the player who scored in Luanda a couple of weeks ago to give Leopard a shock victory over Petro Atletico of Angola. And prior to that, the Swazi side knocked out Wits of South Africa. So they're really on the giant killing run at the moment. It's going to be very tough, Sonny, in Kinshasa in 2 weeks' time in the second leg. But nevertheless, as I said earlier in the show, if you're going to win narrowly at home, 1-0 is the scoreline to achieve. A disappointment was Zamalek of Egypt. They had scored six goals in the previous round, but they drew a blank against Fuz Rabat of Morocco. Zamalek were, by all accounts, woeful in attack. They could barely create a chance throughout the 90 minutes. And sadly, this was a game played at the huge Cairo Stadium. That's a capacity of 70,000, but not a spectator in sight. And that's because of the security issues that are ongoing in Egypt. That really, Sonny, is a big disadvantage to the Egyptian sides. You're talking of Zamalek, you're talking of Al Ahly, and you're talking of Smuha as well. Playing in a sort of funereal atmosphere just does nothing. All our Nigerian listeners, no doubt, keeping their fingers crossed over Wari Wolves, because they're the only Nigerian side left in the African club competitions this year. And Wolves, not really a satisfactory result. They did win 2-1 at home against Etan Chieti of DR Congo, but that's a very narrow lead. And the Congolese in the previous round, they also lost 2-1 away, and then they won by 5-1 at home. So a warning there for Wari Wolves. But I don't see the Wolves collapsing like the Sudanese did. But nevertheless, it's going to be difficult. And both Nigerian goals coming from Salami. He scored twice before Lawamba pulls one back for the Congolese. South Africa, like Nigeria, have only got one representative left in Africa, and that's the famed Orlando Pirates Club from Soweto. They looked as if they were in big trouble against Munana in Libreville when they trailed 2-0 early in the second half. But they fought back, as the Pirates often do, both domestically and in Africa. And Majoro and Rakali, two substitutes, scored to earn Pirates a very praiseworthy 2-2 draw. And with the return match to come at the Orlando Stadium in Soweto, you would have to say the Buccaneers now must be the favourites, Sonny. Not a good weekend, I'm afraid, for the Mali clubs. Ons Couturiers, that means the 11 creators, they conceded a last-minute goal to lose 2-1 at home to ASEC Mimosas. And Djeliba of Mali, a very experienced side when it comes to African football, they lost 2-1 at home to Hearts of Oak of Ghana. And a big high five, Sonny, to the Hearts of Oak of Ghana, because as we reported on a previous edition of the Sunny Side of Sport, they were lambasted before the CAF Confederations Cup began. Former captain of Hearts, Jacob Nettie, who led them to the African Champions League title in 2000, he said it was an absolute waste of time for Hearts to be playing in Africa. He said they lacked the quality to compete, and they were just throwing money down the drain. Well, as I wrote at the weekend, they're certainly not money wasters, whatever they are, because Hearts have now won four of their five games so far in the CAF Confederations Cup, and the other was a draw. And they look set to reach the playoff stage.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa.
They're playing back.
The National Basketball Association playoffs continue later Tuesday night with first-round games in Cleveland, Ohio, Toronto, Canada, and Houston, Texas. The Cleveland Cavaliers are at home against the Boston Celtics. LeBron James and the Cavs lead that series 1-0. The Toronto Raptors host my beloved Washington Wizards. The Wizards waved their magical wands and won the opening game in overtime of that series, 93-86. And the Houston Rockets are at home against their Texas rival, the Dallas Mavericks. The Rockets and one of my favorite players, the bearded James Harden. He's got the best beard in basketball, James Harden. Well, he and the Rockets lead that series 1-0. Remember, VOA basketball fans, all of the series in the NBA playoffs are best of seven games. So the first club to win 4 games advances. In results Monday night, the Chicago Bulls beat the visiting Milwaukee Bucks 91-82, and the Golden State Warriors defeated the New Orleans Pelicans 97-87. Let's take a look at the box scores in those two games. Jimmy Butler scored a game-high 31 points for the Bulls on Monday night, and Joakim Noah, he's the son of former French tennis star Yannick Noah. Joakim had a big game on the boards. He pulled down 19 rebounds. In the Golden State victory, Klay Thompson had a game-high 26 points. That's the same total scored by Anthony Davis of the Pelicans, one of the bright young stars in the NBA. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America. Well, coming up, researchers find they can reduce public defecation by offering subsidies to install toilets in homes. And two organizations work to clean up the main road in the Juba Nabari neighborhood. First, here's Miriam Chemas with Africa Rising.
People, we can't prosper. Somebody bring this boardroom to order.
I justify they won't take us under.
One right can't taste upon the Bible.
Guess the jury know about survival.
We beat the firing squad with no rifles.
Oh, but you mind, this war is mental.
Oh, to a new way, Africa.
Miriam Chemos with Africa Rising. Well, toileting in the outdoors is responsible for infections and deaths in many impoverished communities. Disease-causing bacteria are transmitted through contaminated water and unclean hands. Researchers have found they can reduce public defecation and unsanitary conditions by offering subsidies to install toilets in homes. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
Open defecation is unsanitary. It leads to an estimated 280,000 deaths each year and can stunt the growth of children playing outdoors who risk becoming infected with fecal bacteria. The United Nations has made it part of its 8 Millennium Development Goals to be achieved by this year to reduce outdoor defecation significantly by increasing access to clean latrines. The United Nations says the goal would also reduce sexual violence against women who defecate outdoors. In addition, the sanitation target includes provision of clean, uncontaminated water to the world's impoverished people. That goal of providing potable water to 50% of those who need it has been achieved. Mashfiq Mubarak is an economist at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut.
In the case of access to clean water, we've made more progress, whereas with sanitation, we are far behind the stated goals, and in that over a billion people in the world still continue to practice open defecation. So about 15% of the world's population is still practicing open defecation. And our ultimate goal is to bring that number down to zero.
Toward that aim, Mubarak and co-researchers from the University of Maryland wanted to see whether financial aid would reduce open defecation. They provided vouchers to thousands of villagers in Bangladesh to cover 75% of the cost of installation of clean toilets, and coupled that an information and motivation campaign called the Latrine Promotion Program, or LPP. Other villagers only participated in LPP. The researchers also ensured that more latrines were available for purchase. In 380 rural communities of more than 18,000 households, researchers compared the impact of the LPP with and without vouchers. Educating people about sanitation and offering them subsidies to install toilets were more successful than the motivational campaign alone, or simply increasing the supply of latrines that people could pay for out of pocket. In a study published in the journal Science, investigators report that vouchers for toilets resulted in a 22% reduction in open defecation, while the two other strategies had little or no impact. Mubarak notes some economists and politicians are opposed to providing vouchers as an incentive to install clean toilets.
Unlike the worries that people have had with subsidies, where subsidies might be undermining intrinsic motivation, it looks like over here subsidies are actually necessary and very useful, in addition to doing some information campaigns.
Mubarak says subsidies are offered by charitable organizations like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and some governments have money to help purchase clean toilets. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
The Japan International Cooperation Agency, or JICA, and the Juba City Council are working together to clean up the main road in the Juba Nabari neighborhood. As VOA fellow Lucy Pony reports, the road has fallen into a sorry state in the 18 months since it was built with the help of the Japanese government.
JICA Public Relations Advisor Atong Dimach says a recent visit to the road by Japanese officials prompted the cleanup effort.
The Japanese ambassador, as well as some of our officials, went to visit the roads and see how the community is maintaining the roads. And we were not so impressed with the results because all the roads that we built to make it easier in the raining season are all blocked by all the dirt and the thing that they're throwing on it. So as we approach the raining season, we need to start the cleaning so we can have awareness to the community on how they have to keep it clean. That will be useful for them more for the rainy season.
Before the road was built in 2013, the Juba Nabari community was often flooded during the rainy season. That meant residents had limited access to other parts of the capital and suffered from waterborne diseases. When the road was built, it included concrete culverts to help with drainage. But almost as soon as the Japanese handed the road over to the local community for maintenance, Dimash says it fell into disrepair. She says the culverts are now filled with household trash and sand and no longer serve their purpose. She says they need to be cleaned out before the rainy season starts, which could be as early as next month. Dimash says Jubanabari residents will join Japanese engineers deployed with the UN mission in South Sudan, or UNMISS, and South Sudanese officials for the cleanup operation.
We will have a participation from a number of the community's representatives and volunteers from Jubanabari community, as well as about 40 soldiers. And we also have the participation of the mayor of Juba, Mr. Christopher, as well as Japan ambassador to South Sudan and JICA chief representative. The first, it's tomorrow, which is the 14th, as well as on the 21st, next Saturday, and on the 28th. So it's a three-week cleanup campaign.
The Central Equatorial Ministry of Physical Infrastructure and the UNMISS Japanese Contingent Engineer Company built the Jubanabari Community Road with technical advisory support from JICA. Construction on the Maram roadway with its concrete drainage culverts cost more than $1 million. JICA says the road benefits more than 3,000 households in Jubanabari. Dimash says it is the duty of residents who use the road to maintain it. For VOA News, I'm Lucy Pony.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
UN member states must be held to the highest standards, and at an absolute minimum, we must ensure that national armed forces do not unlawfully recruit and use children, said U.S. Alternate Representative to the United Nations for Special Political Affairs, Ambassador David Pressman. The United Nations makes choices about international responses to conflict through our resolutions, the work of our peacekeepers, the weight of our sanctions, and sometimes, tragically, through our inaction. We have a duty to make choices so that children do not face impossible ones, he said. In 2008, the Child Soldier Prevention Act was signed into law in the United States. This law requires the publication of an annual list of countries whose governments unlawfully recruit and use child soldiers, or governments that support armed groups that do so. Public listings and assistance restrictions, in coordination with concerted engagement of other member states and international actors, are useful tools and have helped encourage governments to take important action, said Ambassador Pressman. There is more the United Nations can do in the common cause for children. First, we can insist on strong human rights reporting in peacekeeping missions, said Ambassador Pressman. Second, we can ensure that child protection issues are on the table during the difficult work of negotiating peace agreements. Third, we must be ready to receive children coming out of conflict with more robust disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration programs. Children are also being lured into war zones to join terrorist organizations committed to a barbaric and violent confrontation with humanity and modernity. We are increasingly seeing young people go to great lengths to join organizations intent on fomenting violence and instilling terror, said Ambassador Pressman. Whether victimized by terrorists or exploitative governments or armed groups, children deserve and need our protection.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
What's going on? What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi right here in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We'd love to have you on board. This is Upfront on the Voice of America. Hot, hot.
Upfront is a show that explores issues
that affect your daily lives. Don't move. Don't move that dial. Get your snacks. Get your cup of tea or your cup of coffee. Put your feet up. This is Upfront. Cheers, cheers. Clink, clink.
Yeah. Now there's a youth culture that is being practiced by the youth globally.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I feel like the problem is that once the funds are sent to these developing countries, it sometimes gets in the wrong hands, and then it's the actual people that are supposed to be benefiting from these funds really never even get to see.
What does this mean for your local culture? Is it being threatened? Should your parents be worried? Let's talk. This is Upfront of the Voice of America. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is @UpfrontAfrica. And remember, you can always send us an email here on the show. It's upfront@voanews.com.